much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. And we're right here with you on Progressive Radio Network. Progressive Radio Network is a wonderful resource for you because you can tune in anytime, day or night, 24/7, to catch up with the latest natural information right here on Progressive Radio Network, as well as cutting-edge politics, all kinds of healthful information for you and your family and loved ones. Today, we have as our guest a great show on one of my favorite topics, since we are herbalists, and that is a guide to the edible and medicinal plants, and particularly of the Finger Lakes Trail. Although that's the name of the book, and it does refer to plants that mostly everyone can find if they're anywhere in the northeastern part of the United States. So it's more broad-based, but that's the name of the book. The author is Heather Housekeeper. Heather is a certified herbalist, long-distance hiker, as well as an author, and she recently published her second book in the series that she is writing on Botanical Hiker. It's called the Botanical Hiker Series. And this particular book, as we mentioned, is a guide to the edible and medicinal plants of the Finger Lakes Trail System. She has thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail, North Carolina's Mountains to Sea Trail twice, and also is the first person ever documented to hike New York's 1,000-mile Finger Lakes Trail System in one continuous trek. Quite an accomplishment. When Heather is not woods rambling or pulling back the pedals out on a botanical find, she educates and guides others into the natural world through ongoing plant walks and workshops. You can learn more about Heather at www.thebotanicalhiker.blogspot.com. And that's where she has all her information, her schedule, and where you can get her wonderful books and lots of other information. So thank you so much for joining us today, Heather.
Thank you, Ellen.
Oh, I hear you there. That's good. That's great. And how I was introduced to Heather was also interesting because I attend many herbal conferences and conventions, and I was actually at more of something that was a social event at my friend's house. He's got a very large, many-acre farm up in upstate New York, and this is a friend of mine since actually childhood. I think we were 16 or 17 when we met, and this was his 37th annual get-together. Boy, been around a long time. And someone who was at that event actually came up to me because I was doing a little herb walk there and identifying some of the plants in the yard just for fun for the attendees. And she told me about you, Heather, and said that you have been really a marvelous asset in learning about edible and medicinal plants. So then Heather and I got in touch, and now we are very happy to bring you her latest book, A Guide to the Edible and Medicinal Plants of the Finger Lakes Trail. So basically, let's go back in time and investigate, Heather, what started you on this path? Because this is both, you know, what you're doing professionally as well as your passion and love.
Well, I think my interest in the natural world really began in childhood. I grew up in a very rural area in northeast Pennsylvania. So my backyard was just forest land. I also grew up next to Gifford Pinchot's estate and his family land, so I had literally over 1,100 acres of just woods to roam. So that was where I spent a lot of my time. I spent a lot of time outdoors, and my grandparents were horticulturalists, So I was introduced to the plants at a young age that way as well. I got older, I can recall very vividly taking rides out into Sussex, New Jersey, and crossing a particular road crossing called Culver's Gap on Route 206. And there I would see the Appalachian Trail through hikers crossing the road to go to a little deli that sat on the other side. And I just thought they were the most intriguing things in the whole world, with their large backpacks and clearly looking like they've been out for a very long time, months perhaps. And that image stuck in my mind as a young adult. I then went on to study plants while I was in college. I went for an environmental studies major. So I spent 2 years in that major and then did end up switching to philosophy, but I continued to study environmental philosophy. But what I really took away from my time in college at a little liberal arts school down in Asheville, North Carolina called Warren Wilson College was my time on the garden crew. So I spent 2 years as well planting, harvesting, weeding, and preparing not only vegetables, but edible and medicinal herbs as well. And I just loved that time, that intimate time with the plants, seeing them throughout all of their stages, and having my hands in the dirt, spending all that time outside. So upon graduating, I thought, well, it's high time to get out on that Appalachian Trail that I'd seen all the hikers out on. You know, my responsibilities were done that way as far as academics, at least for the time being. So I hit the Appalachian Trail, and, you know, I thought I knew quite a bit about the great outdoors, but once I was really out there hiking, I realized how little I knew. I was passing through a virtual green tunnel of what I knew to be useful plants, but I didn't know a lot of their names. I didn't know how to harvest them for food or medicine. And I thought, this is wild. I'm out here for 6 months, you know, eagerly anticipating the next trail town so that I can get all kinds of fresh vegetables and fruits, because I had an interest, or a very strong interest, dedication, I should say, to eating healthfully, and that's a very hard thing to do on the trail. I thought, well, why am I just waiting until I get to town to eat fresh foods when I know they're right here, a virtual produce aisle? So upon completing the Appalachian Trail, then I enrolled in herbal medicine school and just dove into the world of herbs.
Well, that is quite a path. I want to go back to your grandparents, because you mentioned that your grandparents were horticulturists. So were they doing that professionally, and were they more interested in botany or gardening or design? What was their focus?
Well, they had a greenhouse before I was born, so I wasn't there for I wasn't there during that time that they were doing it professionally. But when they moved to Pennsylvania, they had their greenhouse in Fairfield, New Jersey. When they moved to Pennsylvania, they continued to landscape and have a flourishing garden. I grew up in a home with my parents and my paternal grandparents as well, so we lived together. I would regularly go out in the garden with my grandfather, and he would point out to me the tomato plants or the green beans or the onions or whatever it was he had growing at that time. And then my grandmother was into the ornamental plants, so she would have various, which I don't know a whole lot about as far as the ornamental plants go, because that hasn't been my focus, but she would have various plants just all around the property, all around the house.
Well, I find that fascinating because, you know, it's really interesting to see how many of those things are genetic patterns. even our likes and dislikes. For instance, in my case, my maternal grandmother, who was from Greece, was an herbalist and a healer. And in those days, very often, that person actually was the midwife in the village. So a lot of these things do get passed on. And then it's interesting that you started on that path and actually have continued to where now it is actually a very, very deep focus for you. And I'm so happy that you're writing your books, because that's a way that you can share this information with others.
Yeah, I think a lot of the information about how to use our wild edible medicinal plants has been lost, unfortunately. Had I not lived in a home with my grandparents, I probably wouldn't have had access to that information. And as you said, perhaps genetically, you know, some part of me would have still reached out to learn about those plants. I wouldn't have had that up close and personal education with the plants, the botanical world. So what I try and do through my books and through my guided plant walks, my workshops that I lead as well, which typically consists of a 60-minute slideshow featuring 10 plants, which is a lot of plants to get through in 60 minutes, honestly. Sometimes we don't quite make it, is to introduce people to the plants, how to identify them primarily. I want people to be able to go out and recognize these plants for themselves. I don't want them to have to rely upon someone else to harvest them for them or feel like they have to be with someone else. I want to empower people to get out there and know the plants themselves. And then as well, how to harvest them, how to use them. And that's essentially what I do through my book as well. I very much wrote my book like I would lead a workshop or lead a plant walk. And in a plant walk, we go out and actually meet the plants in person. So each plant is featured with a color photo. So that gives you a means to identify it visually, and then a very detailed description of its botanical parts so that you are certain that this is the plant you have at hand, because there can be a number of lookalikes that are either poisonous or, say, simply inedible or not useful medicinally, or even threatened endangered species, which we don't want to accidentally harvest. And then the habitat,
those out in red, which is really helpful.
Yes. Well, the last thing I want somebody to do is accidentally harvest the wrong plant and have a negative experience with that plant. Plants are a little bit safer than, say, mushrooms, you know, which can have there's a number of deadly, very deadly mushrooms. Not as many deadly members of the botanical world. However, they do exist. And a lot of times there's a plant that will have an edible part, but then a very toxic or inedible part. So these are all important things to know when harvesting. And although I am encouraging people to get out there and do this themselves, to have that independence and freedom to find their own food, find their own medicine, it is important in the beginning to spend time with an expert and reading not only my book but various books. Different books are going to give you different insights into how to recognize plants and how to use them.
Well, that all led you to also become quite an avid hiker. And do you also plan on, let's say, writing a book about how to do this a long-term trek where you're staying out for such long periods of time? Because besides learning to eat the plants, there must be other clues as well.
Yes. Well, you know, that's not something I've considered, but maybe I need to, Alan. Yeah, there is a lot that goes into planning for a through hike. And when I say a through hike, I mean hiking continuously over a period of time, hiking an entire trail from one end to the other end. There's a lot that goes into planning for that, and not so much I mean, you have to consider gear. You have to consider what am I going to eat. You have to consider, you know, your stopping points for resupply as far as gear or even staple foods. However, psychologically preparing is the hardest part. I say it's 90% psychological, actually succeeding in through hiking, and 10% physical. A lot of people think the physical aspect is the most challenging, but really spending that time alone, depending upon yourself and an array of unknown factors that you encounter every day, that's the most challenging aspect. And I think really the best way to psychologically prepare for that or deal with it once you're out there is just to go on short hikes by yourself and then gradually lengthen them. Do an overnight, do a couple nights at a time, and take it from there. And really, once you're out there too, that's when you really begin to cultivate that confidence and the ability to remain calm in less than favorable conditions.
Well, I mean, it's a big honor that you are actually recognized as the first person to hike New York's 1,000-mile Finger Lakes Trail system in one continuous trek. Now, we don't know if you really are the first person, because there may have been other people doing it, but no one knew about it. And how did you actually get recognized as having done that? Did you tell people you were going to do it ahead of time and then they documented it?
I did, yes. I reached out to the Finger Lakes Trail Conference and I told them what my plan was to hike the main trail, which is 540 miles, and then the 6 branch trails, which make up the rest of the mileage, by another 400 and some miles, and said, this is what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be researching the plants as I go, documenting what edible and medicinal plants I encounter, and then incorporating them into my backcountry meals and medicines, and then blogging about it as I went. I wanted people to be able to follow me in my journey and learn with me as I hiked. And the Finger Lakes Trail Conference does a very good job of keeping track of when you start, when you finish, how many hikers are out there regularly. You do have to reach out to them, of course, in order to be documented.
Well, that is so excellent that you took the time to do that. And I think, you know, it's a very big deal and a really big honor, and certainly makes you a known professional in the field, in terms of being able to live. And a lot of what you did was eat the wild plants, although I'm sure you came and had groceries at times as well. But throughout your book, A Guide to the Edible and Medicinal Plants of the Finger Lakes Region, of the Finger Lakes Trail, rather, you do on every plant talk about recipes and how you might use that and which ones might be best and, you know, ways that people can start doing right in their yard rather than, let's say, cooking. Now, some of these where you're talking about actually cooking. So did you have a little pot with you? Because you weren't just going around grazing wild plants.
No, I did do a fair amount of grazing, but yes, I was cooking. What I carried was a small alcohol stove. So it weighs literally a couple of ounces and is about the size of a cat food can, very small. And it uses about 2 ounces of either of denatured alcohol as the best fuel you can use. So basically an alcohol with as little water as possible. And then just a small pot that I picked up at I'm not sure, probably a home goods store or something, a very lightweight pot, and that used maybe about 2 liters of water tops is what it would hold. And that's what I would use in the evening to make a fire in the evening after hiking 25 miles, say. You just don't really feel like it. It doesn't it sounds romantic to get to camp and build a fire and cook over an open fire, but typically that's just more work than you feel like dealing with at that time. And also, there's a lot of places in which you can't build fires, depending on where you're camping. So that can be limiting as well.
Well, you know, just wonderful information. So basically, you started out in life with this interest, and then you continued learning about it in college, and then you became certified by going to an herbal school. And you can certainly share with us which herbal school you went to, because, you know, herbal schools are not really recognized necessarily through various licensing boards, but there are certainly some that are excellent. And some kinds of education do give you certifications in herbal medicine, and that includes a naturopathic physician, traditional Chinese medicine. But none of those actually have to do with, let's say, wildcrafting, like what you specialize in.
Well, the school I went to was called the Chestnut School of Herbal Medicine in Asheville, North Carolina. The head instructor, the woman who began the school, she was named Juliet Blankespoor, incredible instructor. And then we had guest instructors as well, like Seven Song from the Northeast School of Herbal Medicine, another incredible program. But our program very much did focus on wildcrafting, going out in the field, meeting and using the plants firsthand. So it was a year-long program, and we would meet a couple times a week and go out all day long and spend time with the plants, meeting the plants, learning how to identify them, harvesting them, and then even processing them, oftentimes in the woods where we harvested them as well. And then we also went out on, 3 10-day field trips, we called them, where we went out into the backcountry, camped, and then spent all of that time doing the very same, going out and identifying the plants, harvesting them, preparing them in the backcountry, and then incorporating them into our into as many meals as we could, usually an evening meal and then breakfast as well. But I found it to be a real immersion into the green, into the botanical world, the green world. I felt like that was when the plants really began to pop for me. You know, before I attended herbal medicine school, it was a green tunnel. But once I began to get to know the plants firsthand, they illuminate. They become vibrant in that green background.
You
recognize your familiar
friends
out there.
As you feel their energy, and a little herb walk that I gave right here on Long Island last Saturday, there was about 25 people, and as we walked around, many of them said that, oh, I have passed this plant, and it was in someone's yard for almost 40 years, and it never looked like sort of an individual entity. It looked like, well, we were talking about sorrel, and everyone just thought it was clover, you know, and
right.
They're really so different when you take a close look at even the individual leaf structure, one being oval and one being heart-shaped. But, you know, unless you take the time to look at it, it just absolutely blends into a green carpet, as you are describing.
One of my favorite things to do when I take folks out for a plant walk is just stop immediately at a grassy area, say near a building or in a parking lot median, and say, you know, let's take a look at all the edible medicinal plants right here. And usually folks, you know, I kind of get a strange look, a sideways look, and but oftentimes that's where you'll find the most. Now, of course, you don't want to harvest there, but these are the common plants that, as you said, people pass daily. They have no idea that these plants are useful for both food and medicine. As you said, wood sorrel and plantain would be another one you'd find there, and dandelion. red clover, white clover even, are common weeds right there for our use.
Absolutely. So we're going to take just a little short break right here, Heather, and when we come back, we will continue our discussion and talk about some very specific herbs that people may find outside and that you documented in your beautiful book, which is a wonderful thing to take with you on a hike, A Guide to the Edible and Medicinal Plants of the Finger Lakes Trail. And you can find out more at thebotanicalhiker.blogspot.com. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll take a look at the soybean, its phytochemistry, and its role as a food and medicine.
It is exciting to see a resurgence in research by universities and food scientists on the role that foods play in disease prevention. Many of these institutions, such as the United Soybean Board, the American Soybean Farmers Association, and the National Cancer Institute, are busy developing designer foods, or superfoods, concentrating the essential nutrients and phytochemicals in soybeans and other foods that have potent medicinal effects. Commonly known foods which have soy in them include soy milk, a cheese-like substance called tofu, tempeh, a fermented soy protein, and tamari, a fermented soy sauce. The soybean is a rich source of many nutrients, including selenium, zinc, beta-carotene, vitamins A, C, and E, and 20 of the 22 amino acids. Soy also contains essential fatty acids.
Research on soy foods is vast and well known to health enthusiasts, although the general public and physicians in the United States may not be aware of this plethora of research. In Japan and China, however, this is not the case, as a voluminous number of scientific studies have been carried out in animals and humans. Chinese studies reveal that soy products can increase the ability, rate of activity, and number of white blood cells. Patients receiving chemotherapy and radiation can benefit from drinking soy milk, which in several studies demonstrated a protective effect on the liver and gastrointestinal system.
It is interesting to note that the British journal Lancet revealed that vegetarians and Asians who ingest high amounts of soy have the lowest rates of cancer. This is due to one of soy's constituents called genistein. This chemical is a phytoestrogen or plant estrogen, which can decrease and block the uptake of human estrogen and testosterone, as well as enhance its excretion. Like the drug tamoxifen, it competes with estrogen for uptake in the reproductive tissues. By doing so, hormone-dependent cancers like ovarian, breast, and prostate cancers may be prevented.
In conditions where there is a deficiency of hormones, such as osteoporosis and menopause, soy isoflavones, such as genistein, can weakly mimic estrogen and reduce the severity of these problems.
So, listeners, don't count out the versatile soybean. Make it a delicious and nutritious part of your natural medicine chest.
And welcome back once again to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thank you so much for joining us today. We invite you to visit us at naturalnurse.com, all one word, naturalnurse.com. And there you can get, listen to our radio shows, which are archived there under media, under radio. You can take a look at our books, which are under products, books, and of course you can join us on any of our online or on-ground courses. To find them, go to calendar, and you'll see a list on calendar of all our up-and-coming dates. We have lots of on-ground and online classes. For instance, we have a class on how to become legally prepared if you feel like you're someone who wants to market homemade herbal remedies, which has a lot to do with our topic that we're talking about today with author Heather Housekeeper and her guide to the edible and medicinal plants of the Finger Lakes Trail. Some people investigate this topic and then feel that they want to make products, so it's a good idea to be prepared with legal information and FDA requirements before you put a lot of time and energy into doing that. And we have classes on how to use herbs medicinally, and as well as collecting outside in the field. We have herb walks going on almost every day in the summer, and some of them are actually medicine-making workshops where you go home taking your own salve, your own tincture, your own extract. We make nervines in the field sometimes, which can be relaxing. We make great cough syrup out of things like cherry bark, all kinds of interesting things. So you can join us. Just go to naturalnurse.com and look at calendar. And we have day-long excursions such as our Chinese medicine excursion, which is coming up in the fall. We also take trips out of the country to live with native shamanic healers, and that comes up always in March. And that actually carries college credits, if you need any, and many of our online classes also offer CE credits, which are ongoing educational units for such people as nurses, massage therapists, acupuncturists, and if you're not licensed, you can get a certificate for having taken those classes. So we look forward to hearing from you, and we love hearing from you. Today, we want to reintroduce our guest, Heather Housekeeper, and she's a certified herbalist, long-distance hiker, and author. And she has thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail as well as North Carolina's mountains, and recently was documented as the first person to hike New York's 1,000-mile Finger Lakes Trail system in one continuous trek. So she is definitely a well-trained expert and just a wonderful resource in terms of learning about edible and medicinal plants, not only of the Finger Lakes Trail, but really of the Northeast, because many of the plants we'll talk about now, if you're in the Northeast, you have them in your yard. If you're one of my listeners, and I know there are actually thousands of you in Florida, where I live most of the year, those are completely different plants. We don't have too many crossover plants unless you're in northern Florida, like Jacksonville and even up to Orlando. But as you start getting in southern Florida, where I live, really the landscape changes. So maybe Heather will come there one day and actually try a whole new scene and all different kinds of edible and medicinal plants. But today we are going to focus on what she has written about in great detail, and that is the plants that are found in the Northeast region. So thank you so much for joining us again, Heather.
Thank you, Ellen.
So let's go right into some of the specific plants that are so well researched and documented. In every case, you have the common name, you have the family, you have the genus and species name, which is very important if we're going to be professional herbalists so that we can be sure we're talking about the same plant. And then you have an absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous picture. And I think you actually are the photographer of most of these pictures.
I am. Most all of these were taken on the Finger Lakes Trail during my thru-hike.
So let's talk about daylily, because a lot of people can identify them. They're absolutely gorgeous. And you also don't really want to confuse them with other cultivated varieties, such as tiger lily.
Correct, correct. Well, daylily, one of the best ways to know that you have a daylily at hand and not, say, a tiger lily, is daylily is going to have what looks like six petals. These are in actuality three petals cupped by three sepals. So sepals are the botanical parts that are often right behind, that are always right behind the petals. But it's going to look like, at first glance, like it has six large orange petals. Daylily will never have spots in the throat of the flower, like you would see
That's a big
in
one.
Other
right.
lilies.
Yeah.
It's going to instead have a lighter colored orange vertical stripe going down each of those three petals. So not the sepals, but the three petals will have vertical, a lighter stripe of orange going down each one into the throat. So that's one of the best ways to know. Daylilies, at this point, they are in full bloom and can be anywhere from 3 feet to nearly 5 feet tall. So a very tall plant. The blossoms will not be drooping like you would see on some lilies with backward bending petals. They'll be open like a beautiful cup or a chalice facing upward towards the sunlight. There will not be, typically not all of the blossoms open at once. This plant is literally called daylily because each blossom opens for just a day, and the plant is intelligent enough to not open all of its flowers at once. So you'll usually find daylily with unopened flower buds, open blossoms, and then blossoms that have already opened and closed and are beginning to wither.
Now, do the blossoms actually only last one day? Is that where this name came from?
Exactly, yes. The scientific name, the genus name Hemerocallis, translates directly to day beauty, actually.
Nice.
So that gives us a little insight. Another reason why it's good to learn the scientific names, because oftentimes the scientific names can be a little reminder as to what either what the plant is good for or some botanical aspect of that plant.
Now, I know people who just pop off that flower and add it to salads and use it also, you know, for light cooking. And then in your book, you also talk about using the tubers as well.
Yes. Well, the tubers before the plant has flowered are essentially like small potatoes. They're crunchy. They can be eaten raw or cooked. So a little different from a potato there. We wouldn't normally eat a potato raw. But they're very small, kind of almost like little fingerling potatoes. But once the plant has flowered, they can tend to get a little slimy. You know, the plant is putting its energy into its flower at that point. So we're past that point. But if you wanted to harvest for the tubers, the best thing to do is to know exactly where you have a community of daylily. You don't want to accidentally harvest, say, iris or a daffodil. They will have different root systems. However, when you're first beginning to learn about plants, that can still be a hard thing to distinguish, and the leaves can be very similar without the flowers being there as a guaranteed indicator of what you have. So know where you have a community of daylily. Very well could be in your front yard if you've planted them, or in a neighbor's yard who doesn't mind you coming to harvest a few. And then return to that spot in the early spring when the greens are just beginning, the leaves are just beginning to come up.
I always find that suggestion you just made, where you're doing your identification at some time of the year, because these plants look so different all different times of the year, that once you've made that identification, I think I even saw an app yesterday. It's called Forager Helper or something like that, where you can take a picture of the plant and it saves that to a map so you can find out where it is, let's say next spring, because some things you want to gather in the early spring. So then you know where it is. But you have to learn to recognize it in its various incarnations during the year.
Correct. Yes, and daylilies, while I'm on the topic of harvesting from your yard or your neighbor's yard, Daylilies are now in a number of cultivars. There's thousands of varieties of daylily. We know for certain that the orange daylily, scientific name Hemerocallis fulva, is definitely edible. It's very likely that the other varieties are edible and delicious as well, but we haven't taste tested all of those. So I suggest that people stick to Hemerocallis fulva, just the orange daylily.
Yeah, and they're the ones that really are wild. At least I see them all over in the woods, even if they have not been planted. And people, like myself, have actually taken them out of the woods and transplanted them at my house, where they're a beautiful perennial that come back every year.
Yes, yes. Daylilies, they're a non-native plant that has naturalized throughout our woods, but they were originally and our roadsides, but they were originally brought here to this country as a food plant because they were being used as food.
I did not know that. That's really interesting. I'm always having this discussion, sometimes rather heated, with various people who are very against invasive plants, and they actually go throughout the woods killing invasive plants and pulling them out everywhere. And sometimes those are, you know, highly edible and medicinal species as well.
I agree. There is incredible value in our non-native and even invasive plants. I feel like the lines have certainly blurred at this point as to what plants are native and non-native. If a plant has been here, say daylily, since the 18th century, you know, at what point do we say, okay, this plant is now? When does a non-native become a native? Dandelion that's been here for centuries. Can we really still call that a non-native? These plants have become part of the natural landscape, part of the ecosystem, and yes, a lot of our non-native plants do have the ability to outcompete our native plants, so then we run into an issue there. But some of these are harmless. You know, they don't outcompete because of the disturbance, the human disturbance that they may require to grow. Say, mullein, for example, which is a non-native plant that has naturalized throughout our human-disturbed areas. You are never going to find mullein growing deep in a healthy woods because it requires soil disturbance. It requires gravelly, dry.
Wait a minute, Heather. You switched plants on us, so let's just do
sorry.
That. That's okay.
I get excited.
We are
going
to have to take another little break, so we may as well do that now. We're going to do Station IV. ID rather for PRN, which is Progressive Radio Network. And when we come back, since it naturally evolved into a discussion about mullein, which I absolutely adore, and it's really so easy to identify once people know what it is. And so we'll continue our discussion with mullein when we come back and listen to all the great shows you can find right here on Progressive Radio Network.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm David Crow, host of The Infectious Myth, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm. I love science the way it should be practiced, but a lot of modern science is corrupted by financial interests and serves a master other than the public good. Myths continue to be constructed around viruses, vaccines, forensics, and pharmaceutical drugs. People are dying and ending up in jail because of them. Listen to me as I deconstruct the myths that those who call themselves scientists weave, or when I wander into social and political topics. If you're new to the show, check out our past episodes at infectiousmyth.podbean.com.
Love, Lust, and Laughter, Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm your host, Dr. Diana Wiley, a board-certified sex therapist and a marriage and family therapist. Guests, colleagues, authors are interviewed, and we sometimes dispense advice to create a format that is both informative and entertaining. If you can't listen live, go to the archives and even rate the show on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope that you are coming with us.
Thank you for listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
And thank you so much for joining us today. We are talking today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z with Heather Housekeeper. That's Houskeeper. No E in the house. Housekeeper. It must be a German kind of name, Heather, I imagine. And we're talking about her book, A Guide to the Animal. Huh?
Thank you for spelling it. That's a common spelling error there.
Yeah, they put house in there, I'm sure. So the name of her book is A Guide to the Edible and Medicinal Plants of the Finger Lake Trail. The only thing that's difficult in today's show is you can't see this beautiful book with its excellent and wonderful photographs, mostly taken by Heather herself on her many hikes into these trails. And right now we're going to talk about a plant where we left off, and this is just one of my favorite plants because it's so distinctive, big and beautiful, as well as being useful, and this is called mullein, also in the figwort family. So let's talk about mullein now, Heather.
Well, I'm sure many of our listeners right now are seeing mullein along the road signs, perhaps along gravelly embankments. Maybe on the edges of parking lots or alleyways. This is a plant that likes urban thickets and human-disturbed places. Ultimately, it requires that disturbed soil, dry, gravelly, sandy, in order to continue thriving. So it's not a plant, although it's non-native, that would outcompete our native plants. Medicinally, it has a couple of parts that can be used medicinally. So let me step back a moment here. Actually, mullein is going to be a very tall plant, about 4 feet tall. It's going to look kind of like a golden spire, or sometimes it can be even branching, which is its rarer form, like a candelabra, very, very tall. And you'll often see the dried seed stalks beside a flourishing plant, or you'll see them throughout the winter. So that makes it a more obvious plant. But it begins as a basal rosette in its first year of large woolly leaves, very felt-like. Each leaf is oblong and can reach over a foot long. In its second year, it'll send up a stalk with alternate leaves, and I'd say the top third of that stalk is flowering. The flowers are five-petaled and yellow, and somewhat similar to daylily, not all of the flowers will bloom at once. They'll actually bloom in a spiral from the base of the plant upward. So you'll never see the whole stalk in bloom. But those flowers are excellent medicinally. You can submerge them in organic, high-grade quality olive oil, and allow them to infuse that oil, and then that oil can be used with a dropper as an ear oil to unclog ears.
That really works. I want to share that. My own children, who are now in their 40s, I used to actually, anytime they started having any kind of signs of a respiratory infection or an ear infection, always I would put drops of mullein flower ear oil, one drop in each ear. And it really was fantastic preventatively. I will say my own children never once were put on antibiotics, and I really think if parents have that kind of knowledge of what to do preemptively, that really antibiotics should be able to be avoided. It's not just mullein flower ear oil, but an entire protocol. But it really, really is so soothing and works well.
I, too, have used the mullein oil for my own ears and have found it works incredibly well. Yes, yes, very definite results. Each winter, or oftentimes in the winter, I will get one good head cold. And, you know, sometimes you can have that remaining congestion in the head. And mullein oil is great for just opening the ears, removing that congestion, allowing you to breathe and hear better. The leaves are also excellent for opening the lungs and as a mild expectorant. So this is not the kind of expectorant that's going to make you hack and cough and get a bunch of phlegm up, but one that's going to open the lungs, be soothing to the lungs, actually bring a little bit of moisture to the lungs to decrease inflammation that would be causing a hacking cough. So the leaves can be dried and then steeped in a tea, or they can be used fresh, but then you want to make sure that you are straining the tea through through a cloth to remove the hairs that could be agitating to the throat.
Yeah, and you know, I have a wonderful picture because you do talk about smoking mullein leaves, and I actually have this fantastic photo from Appalachia of a grandfather teaching his grandson to smoke mullein leaves rolled into a homemade cigarette. And I actually do use that with my patients all the time who are trying to stop smoking tobacco, because they say that the mullein smoke is actually good as a mild expectorant, and especially when combined with lobelia, because lobelia fits into nicotine receptor sites, so that can block the temptation to smoke, both by providing a smoke alternative and by decreasing a nicotine desire. So we have found that that really works, you know, very well, and is also a long time, well-tested folk remedy.
Yes, traditionally mullein was smoked, and that's not, I don't have experience personally with smoking mullein, but the old timers and the Native Americans, they certainly knew how to use our plants for medicine, so I'm sure that there is validity there.
Now, I'm a little surprised because I've never thought, and I always learn more. I've learned so much from your book. You actually have a caution with mullein. I always think of it as a plant that does not have too many problems with herb-drug interactions. Of course, anyone can be sensitive to anything, but you're talking about using the leaves directly as a skin rub, that may cause some kind of skin condition like contact dermatitis.
Yes, the leaves can be very tempting, especially to children. And I do take children out on plant walks as well. You know, as soon as you see a mullein leaf, because it literally looks like a large piece of felt, you just want to rub it on your face or rub it on your arm to feel that softness. And typically, you know, quickly a momentary contact is not going to cause a problem. It's not like poison ivy or wild parsnip or something like that where it's going to have a terrible reaction. But you wouldn't want to have prolonged contact with the leaves, because that could potentially cause just a rash to outbreak or an itchiness. Again, it's not like poison ivy where it's going to spread and it's going to be persistent, but just a a mild dermatitis.
You know, well, poison ivy is not a bad plant to discuss, because I think anybody who's going to follow in your footsteps and actually be in the woods a lot should certainly learn how to identify it.
And poison ivy is a plant that can be somewhat hard to identify at first if you're just beginning to get to know the plants, because it's green. there's not anything that is real distinctive upon first glance. However, the rule of three leaves is one of your best indicators. Poison ivy will always have three leaves, and they will either be deeply lobed or just very mildly lobed. Poison ivy is never going to be toothed. That's one of your best ways to know that you have poison ivy versus, say, blackberry or raspberry, which is actually a beneficial plant. Poison ivy is never going to have teeth, and it's vine-like, so you'll often see it growing up the sides of trees, crawling along the ground. It's not going to be, say, an arching cane like blackberry or raspberry, and I'm bringing up those plants because I know often on my plant walks, someone will see a blackberry or a raspberry leaf and say, oh my goodness, that's poison ivy, don't go near that. And it's too bad because they're missing out on a lot of people, that tells me, are missing out on a beneficial plant. And poison ivy also doesn't have thorns. Often as
That's
it gets older,
one,
it'll
sure.
have tendrils, or not tendrils, but rootlets that it uses to cling to a tree or whatever it's climbing. And it can look very, very hairy.
We're actually coming to the end of our discussion, so I suggest, if this interests you, get a copy of Heather's book, A Guide to the Edible and Medicinal Plants of the Finger Lakes Region. Wonderful information, identification, gathering, recipes, warnings, and cautions. And then you can always also join her on a walk. Go to www.thebotanicalhiker.blogspot.com to find out more. And you can always go to naturalnurse.com to get copies of our radio shows as well as other information that we have free for you there. So, Heather, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Ellen.
And thank you, listeners. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.